if our AI models are saying one thing and the indigenous elders who have lived on that land for many, many generations, we will follow the guidance of the elders every single time. That's a commitment we're making as a company because that's the way that we can ensure that what we're doing is going to be good for everybody involved and good for the land itself.
This is The Butterfly Effect, a podcast that shows the big impact a small action can do. Tali Urat is talking to those special people that make a difference with nature and trees.
Welcome everyone to The Butterfly Effect. My name is Tali Urat. I'm your host and your butterfly here. Today I have two special guests, Troy Carter and Patrick Leong. They are both co-founders of Earthshot. Troy is the CEO of Earthshot, which is building the technology for planetary scale ecological restoration. He is also the co-founder at Rhizom, which is pioneering the use of bamboo-engineered lumber as a climate-positive alternative to wood, steel, and concrete. He is bringing the audacious scale and vision of startup methodology to the planet's ecological and climate crisis. Patrick has spent 2 decades in the tech industry as an engineering leader. At Google, he worked on Google Maps, emerging markets, and the Google Duplex conversational AI system. Patrick was the CTO at Two Sigma Private Investment, where he pioneered the use of data science and machine learning in private equity markets. I'm excited to have them both here. Welcome, Troy and Patrick, to The Butterfly Effect.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah.
This is so cool to have two butterflies here. So let's first start by both of you are co-founders of Earthshot. So do you mind sharing with us a little bit what you do there?
Absolutely. Patrick and I co-founded Earthshot in service of planetary ecological regeneration. So what does that mean? It means that we are in a climate crisis and we are in a crisis of multiple systemic collapse in ecological systems all around the planet, in forests, in ocean, in soil, in animals and plants and biodiversity. Mm-hmm. And we need to do something about that. And we can. And so there's a few things that Earthshot is doing specifically to address ecological restoration for its own sake. So the first is we have formed an open source coalition of many different universities, academics, and individual contributors to build scientific consensus on how to measure nature better, specifically predicting into the future what happens based on different interventions. And the reason we're doing this is because we need to change investment decisions, policy decisions, and landowner decision-making at a massive scale, because land is sort of the biggest lever we have to actually go and change human relationship with non-human nature. And so the second thing we're doing is building a product called LandOS. And LandOS is exactly what it sounds like. It's an operating system for land. And it basically is the easiest way for a land steward, so someone who owns land in any country in the world, to get paid for doing something good for the planet. And the mechanism is right now through carbon markets. So by planting trees or protecting the forest, a land steward in the Amazon or in Kenya or in the United States, and we'll be onboarding many, many countries over the coming years, to actually get paid for doing activities that are good for the planet. And this could be sort of like supplemental income from their farms, but it could also just be like one of their primary activities, or for a tribe that's been protecting land for a long time, to have them actually get paid for doing their work. Mm-hmm. And the third thing we're doing is leading projects on the ground. So this is really about building a investment case for doing reforestation, because right now the philanthropic ecosystem just isn't big enough to handle the immensity of the land degradation that has happened. And so we need to access the trillions of dollars in cash and private equity money to actually go build reforestation and land restoration as an investable asset class. and direct much larger amounts of money from corporations, from governments, and from individuals, and direct those payments to land stewards.
That's pretty awesome. And you threw a lot of things that you're doing and I love it, and it's super exciting. And I kind of like want to pick on to first ask you, it's amazing this land OS where locals can benefit from what they're actually doing. You mentioned selling carbon. I'm just curious, how are you mitigating corruption and double selling and all those things that we are seeing right now in the rise?
To be very honest, carbon markets have not worked. And they've been around for a few decades. And we can see that they haven't worked because the problems have gotten greater and greater. Rates of deforestation have accelerated. And, you know, land use conversions into sort of irresponsible agriculture and timber practices have also accelerated. So something has to change. And what has to change is the level of rigor and standards, quality of verification, scalability of verification. So there, you know, this is such a nascent area that all of the very basic things that the carbon market needs in order to function well, they just haven't been developed yet. So right. We're working in a lot of different areas to actually make things like double counting. Like this is a very basic problem. We should have a registry that accurately monitors what ecosystem services are being sold to whom and where. In terms of quality of carbon, you know, we need to be focusing on like biodiverse native ecosystems, not monoculture eucalyptus or renewable energy. At least that's our perspective.
No, I totally agree. And it goes hand in hand, because if you have a monoculture, even if it's the forest of all of it is the same tree, it doesn't sequester carbon as much as a natural forest, which is more biodiverse. And there's other aspects to it. But I'm still going back to that question, because it's great that it's a problem. It's great that we need to solve it. But how are you making sure that your farmers are not double selling it because they can? And how are you making sure that your stewards that you're working with are working the right way and supporting the climate and the environment and the biodiversity and ecosystem and the soil, blah, 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 everything that goes in?
Yeah. So just the issue of double counting, I mean, the reality is carbon markets have been tiny. So the number of landowners actually participating in markets is really small. So honestly, double counting is sort of like a great like marketing ploy for like a news service to say there's a problem with the market. But honestly, it doesn't really exist in any wide scale way. And that's because the number of landowners doing this is so small. We need to go from literally hundreds of carbon projects a year to hundreds of millions of projects in order to address this at scale. And if we have 100 million, you know, participants in this market, then we're going to have to start facing fraud and other ways of detecting sort of like bad intent from people. But right now it's actually, you know, it's a pretty small issue. And it's a very simple fix. You just have a big registry that identifies every parcel of land on Earth and has a complete global accounting system for all ecosystem services that are being paid, and be very collaborative. You know, right now there are different registries. There's Verra. There are different third-party verification standards, and we need to more and more collaborate with each other to share all of our data, share all the models. That's why we started the Earthshot Institute, which is a nonprofit open science institution to build scientific consensus on these questions.
Can I just add a little bit here that might be helpful? Our view is that unlocking supply is the main problem. It's you know, people ask us about competition, people ask us about the you know, additionality, and in our view, we need to unlock supply by inspiring landowners with the possibility of restoration on their land, like the different things they can do. And that's why we're taking a really expansive approach towards modeling land restoration using advanced machine learning and AI kind of techniques, so that the landowner has a really clear view on the future biomass and biodiversity potential of their land. They get inspired. They also can see quantitatively what the future revenue potential is on the carbon markets and otherwise. And that's the goal, is to use these numerical techniques and basically unlock supply so that we can dramatically increase the amount of restoration projects that are out there and really restore nature at planetary scale.
Inspiring others by giving them an example of something that works is usually the way to go. And you mentioned also reforestation and land restoration in that. Do you want to elaborate?
So we are starting by focusing on reforestation and assisted natural regeneration projects. We have pilot project in Panama, and we have other projects in Brazil and the US and other countries coming up in our pipeline. And we're using machine learning combined with field observations in order to predict future biomass growth, in order to assess the restoration potential and the carbon revenue and other factors that arise from these projects. And we have on-the-ground operation teams that are in these countries that are working directly with land stewards in order to make this happen on the ground.
So it's not that you're planting, it's they're planting and you're supporting them with your tools.
Yes, we definitely are supporting them with tools. We have a number of different technology solutions that Troy mentioned earlier. We also have a reforestation operations team that's working directly with land stewards in order to either find local companies locally that can do the land restoration in partnership with us, or to actually directly employ people to do this work.
And when you talk about technology and AI, what exactly are you doing and how does it work?
There's two different ways, broadly speaking, that we're using AI with our products. The first is, in order to really come up with accurate carbon forecasts and biomass growth forecasts, you need to have accurate on-the-ground observations in terms of tree species, diameter, and location. And we're developing an app called Biome that essentially uses computer vision in a number of different ways in order to really accurately and very, very efficiently and effectively measure trees. And so this is currently a process that requires tape measures and transcribing measurements from that are observed using the tape measure onto some kind of system that involves human error and is time consuming and costly. And our app, we aim to make measuring trees as easy as scanning a barcode, which requires a lot of machine intelligence to do effectively. And then we have, as Troy mentioned before, the LandOS product. And the idea there is to use these on-the-ground nature observations around tree location, species, and diameter in conjunction with remote sensing data, including satellite, near-infrared, LiDAR data, in order to more effectively predict biomass over large regions. And so that requires using various methods, deep learning and otherwise, in order to forecast carbon levels, carbon sequestration on the land through time. And so our goal is to, and we already have initial models that predict this over the course of the next 30 years for a given plot of land. And this is instrumental in creating high quality carbon offsets.
I think that's brilliant that you are using technology to support nature-based technology.
Thank you.
You're using your land owners to use the app to give you the data, or you bring your own people?
So this is one of the big sort of revolutions in what we're doing, because right now, in order to develop a carbon project or a land restoration project that you can actually go sell to a government or corporation, you basically have to hire professional consultants to walk around your land, do field plots. And these people are really expensive. So the professional consulting process to develop this project, it could be $500,000 or $1 million to go build out a carbon project. And that makes it totally out of reach for almost everyone on Earth, except the very largest landowners, NGOs, and corporations. And so what we're trying to do is democratizing this process. And so the ability for someone to go through a self-guided process to onboard their land onto an aggregated project, sell that into a carbon market, get paid with very, like, where they don't have to have a very sophisticated understanding of like where the credit goes or who it gets sold to. but instead just walk around with their smartphone taking pictures of trees, and then our system takes care of the rest. Yeah, we're trying to make it as easy for you to use for anyone on Earth. So, and that's really the goal of elegant design.
Do you have any success story or an example?
We're just in the field testing stage for Biome right now. So our team is working in Panama to build training data sets. So one of the, maybe a little bit of technical here, imagine the Tesla self-driving car. You know, you see these cars driving around the city, just basically learning how to drive from human experience. Mm-hmm. And that's the same way we're developing the Biome app. So the more and more people that take pictures of trees, the better the app gets and the more it learns. So right now we're in a training data phase. We're taking a bunch of pictures of trees. And so in each new location, we need to learn what those trees look like. So right now we're working in Panama to build out sort of a Latin American tropical forest database. And this is bringing a lot of new data to science, because right now it's very, very time consuming and difficult to understand what's going on in a forest. And so this is both a sort of scientific project in collaboration with the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute and other research institutions. And so we're doing some pretty cutting edge work in this area.
That's pretty cool. And do you see a difference in the same air quote type of tree in different locations of the world?
To be honest, it's very easy to understand the volume of a Douglas fir that's, you know, has these straight sides and looks pretty much like a cylinder or a very, very tall cone. Mm-hmm. And when you get to these more complex jungle environments, you know, the human can sort of understand what's a tree and what's not a tree. But it's actually quite complex to build a model on a computer and actually that runs on a smartphone in the background all the time that understands what a tree is and what a tree is not, and then build a map of the jungle. But that's what we're doing. Another analogy for what we're doing is, you know, remember maps, like these physical paper maps. And then there was MapQuest, where you sort of had this numerical model for, you know, turn left, turn right, and this set of instructions. And then Google Maps, which is sort of like everyone's giving their user, like all the users, all of us are giving their data to Google all the time to, you know, build models of traffic patterns and optimizing the best route and changing in the mid direction. And that's basically what we're doing for the forest, is going from tape measures to these numerical models, allometry equations for tree growth, into a neural network architecture that is a much more complex way, but that everyone on Earth can download the Biome app, take pictures of trees, and that helps the model learn so that in, you know, 5 years and 10 years, we'll be able to understand ecology in a way that humans have never been able to understand the world at scale.
So it's ways for trees.
Exactly. Ways for trees.
It's funny you should say that. Like, I actually worked on Google Maps when I was back at Google, and there were some problems that Google was tackling that could only be solved by gathering data from people who were volunteering things, just like with Waze. And that's what we're going for here. Only this time it's, you know, really there's a lot at stake in terms of providing this really vital information for ecological research and being able to really put together high quality carbon offsets so we can incentivize the restoration of nature.
And can anybody do that? I mean, whoever is listening right now, can they download the app, take pictures?
So the idea is that this is a citizen science app. And so anyone's going to be able to download it and essentially contribute to science by gathering nature observations, starting with tree measurements. But we have a whole long list of really interesting additional nature observations that people can take. And we'll have ways of directing people to the right areas in order to where we really need the data on the ground. So we can identify trees and we can measure them more accurately and we can find various natural features that are really useful for ecological science.
Yes. Do you have a forecast on the Panama jungle?
Yes, we've done some initial analyses on the biomass growth that's very localized to that area. And we're constantly doing fine-tuning work in order to improve the accuracy of that model using backtesting and other means. So we're getting there. And once we have the model really fine-tuned and deployed for Panama, we really have an accurate view on the map and we have carbon offsets on the market, we can scale that up to other regions.
Yeah. You are also working on Rhizome?
So Rhizome is a great example of a company working on a specific sort of vertical solution to climate change. So it's doing bamboo engineered lumber and reforestation in Southeast Asia. And bamboo engineered lumber is, you know, a technology to replace wood, steel, and concrete with bamboo. And hopefully, you know, in the coming decades, we will see more and more building products made out of bamboo. And that's also something we're doing at Earthshot, which is incorporating agroforestry products like bamboo, because the way we use land, it can't just be taking the humans off and making, you know, 50% of the world into conservation, even as much as I think that would be amazing. Mm-hmm. The economic pressure to cut down the forest is really strong, even in conservation protected areas, national parks. You know, in the US, we think of national parks as like, oh, they're, you know, no one's going to cut down the forest, but that's not the case in most places of the world. And so we need an economic solution more than just a policy solution. And the economic solution is by incorporating food crops and timber crops and agroforestry products like bamboo in order to have local people actually make money from the forest and be able to make a livelihood and have food security. And so Rhizome is a very elegant solution in incorporating bamboo into a native reforestation project and, you know, building local bamboo cooperatives and manufacturing process that actually makes people money.
So bamboo is being one of the most important non-wood species, and it is, as you said, a great alternative for wood manufacturing material. And I mean, we see it in furniture and right. even paper and fiberboard and all those other things. Yeah. So it's absolutely amazing. I just didn't know that you can use it for replacing steel and concrete.
Yeah. Well, it's got to be really big bamboo. So most of the bamboo that we see, you know, there are these, you know, just much smaller species. But the bamboo in the Philippines and Indonesia and Southeast Asia in particular are massive. They can be 12 inches across, 100 to 120 feet tall. So that's really, really large pieces of wood. And so you can actually cut small boards out of the bamboo and glue them together into pretty much any configuration you want.
And can you build anything from them? I mean, today with concrete and steel, we build bridges and skyscrapers.
Yes, for sure you'll be able to build skyscrapers. Bridges, you know, it's not like a great external material because still it's just like wood. Like we don't build wooden bridges anymore. But skyscrapers are mostly covered in a sheath, so of glass or windows. And so we can totally imagine, just as mass timber buildings with wood are coming out and some very, very tall buildings, 50-story plus buildings are being planned, bamboo is actually a better, stronger, more fire-resistant, much greater tensile strength than wood. So we can actually see buildings made out of bamboo very soon.
And is it more expensive to manufacture?
It won't be. It has to reach scale.
Okay, so we're not there yet in terms of scale.
We're not there yet, in a few years.
Okay, and you mentioned that it can be brought into the farmer. Can anybody farm it, or is it in a specific location?
So all around the tropics, bamboo is a great crop to grow. And, you know, that's also something that we're looking to incorporate our projects, even in the United States. Is, you know, what if we plant 1% or 5% of the land that we're, you know, developing for carbon projects at Earthshot into, you know, bamboo? And this could be near harvestable areas and also in areas where it's just, you know, where there's road access or closer to towns where people need access to building materials or, you know, wood for charcoal. We'd much rather have people cutting down bamboo every year or every few months rather than going to a hardwood or a hardwood forest and cutting that down. Because bamboo is super sustainable. You know, you cut it down and in 18 months, you have a massive pole that has regrown from that stock.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned already two fun facts about bamboo. Do you have others that you can share?
It grows super fast. I mean, literally, you can go put a stalk of bamboo in the ground, and in 3 years, you will see a full-sized plant harvestability in 6 or 7 years. And it's wonderful. You know, you can eat the shoots. So it's sort of like a food security mm-hmm. crop. You can build out of it. You can make paper. Like the vast multitude of uses is incredible. And it's by far got the highest biomass growth rate of any plant on land, which means that it sequesters carbon and is a great climate solution.
Is there meaning to the word rhizome?
Rhizome is the underground root system of bamboo and any other grass.
How did you end up doing all that?
Earthshot was really born out of a collaboration between myself and Patrick. Most businesses with a lot of longevity, like there's always a partnership, like there's always a relationship at the core of these endeavors. Like it's just too much work to do with one person. We have to form deep coherence and work on something together. So that's really the process that we're in right now, is building out the team. And how this came about was really a series of conversations that Patrick and I have had over the past few years to identify the high leverage points to use technology and change economic systems so that people have different incentives to how to treat the forest. Because this is not, we can't just say, oh, you know, we have the information or we have the science, everyone should change. Mm-hmm. No, there actually need to be economic and policy decisions that are made in order to change people's incentives. Because people have to eat and they want to take care of their families. And so they will make the best decisions available to them. And often that decision is not in the best interest of the long-term health of the planet. And so we need to change that.
Yeah.
Can I tell the origin story? So, you know, I've spent my whole career in tech, and I worked at Google for many, many years. And I worked at Two Sigma Investments, a big hedge fund, for a couple of years. And I was at this spiritual retreat in Hawaii. In the middle of that jungle, I just really felt like, wow, the earth is hurting. Like this planet is really suffering from all the things that humans do in order to find their food, fuel, and fiber. I just felt a strong calling to really direct my experience and my talents and my intention towards solving this problem. And literally a couple of days after that, I met Troy, who at that time was living in Hawaii and close by the retreat center. And we really had a sort of a melding of ideas and of experiences, because I'd had quite a bit of experience applying machine learning to private investing through my time at Two Sigma, and of course a lot of software development experience from Google. And then Troy had been working on Rhizome, doing mm-hmm. regenerative agriculture, and also had experience in the finance world. And it was kind of really a weaving of different intentions as far as, well, how might we use data science and machine learning in service of the planet in order to restore nature at global scale? And that's the sort of the cauldron from which Earthshot was born. And there was this really strong sense that we wanted to create a culture that was really different, a place where people could really feel at home and bring their full selves into the workplace. And I hadn't really experienced that in my career. Despite working for some amazing companies, I just didn't really quite feel like the culture had fully embraced me personally. And we had a longing to create an environment where people could come and really feel like they were themselves. And that's what we're doing. And it's not easy. And as Troy was saying, I couldn't even imagine trying to do this on my own. It's just way too much to get done and way too much to hold in my heart and in my head to make such a venture really happen. And so I'm very grateful to have found a partner that I can really, can meet me where I am and to really work with on this. And I think things are going very, very well so far with our partnership and with the company.
Patrick, that's a very inspiring story. So what is your biggest challenge right now?
Hiring amazing people who fit in with our culture and who meet the needs of the organization. Because we want to create with the first few hires, with the first few dozen hires that we make, it's super important that we have people who can resonate with the mission strongly and who bring some kind of a genius into this that helps us accomplish what we need to accomplish to fulfill our mission, and who really have a strong heart-centered approach to their lives and to their work. And this is not easy. And we are also building a very diverse, culturally, ethnically diverse team And these are all challenges that that we're very, very serious about in terms of building the right team to solve this.
So you're bringing the forest to the workplace, literally.
Oh, yes.
With biodiversity.
Many of the key insights and intentions around Earthshot were set with essentially Troy and I going for barefoot hikes in the forest. So that's very well put.
So you mentioned your spiritual retreat in Hawaii, which for me, when you talk spirituality, I always go to the indigenous people and their communities. Do you have any thoughts, any way that you incorporate or make sure that their voices are heard, and it's not just a farmer, and it's not just the, we talked about national parks, so it's not just the country, but also the indigenous people that are living there, that their voices are heard and taking into consideration?
Yeah, so we believe this is really, really essentially important, and we don't hear a lot about indigenous rights or practices or knowledge in the space of ecological restoration and carbon markets and so on. And we think this is something that we want to really promote and really be a key part of, because what we don't want to have happen is us to be this kind of global technology company that applies land restoration techniques without really thinking about and taking into account the needs of the people on the land and the traditions and the ancient knowledge that surrounds that land as well. I'm from New Zealand, as I might have mentioned before, and I have a Maori lineage. My matrilineal line is all Maori from the Ngāpuhi tribe in the north of New Zealand. And there's a long history of really applying notions of sacredness and notions of personal power and the power of the collective in terms of how the land is treated in humans' relationship with non-human nature. And we want to bring these ideas into Earthshot, and we've actually forged a partnership with The Fountain, which is an indigenous elder council that's done some really, really amazing work engaging with the UN and other key groups in the world in order to really bring sacred knowledge and ancient wisdom into the field of land restoration and community building and so on. So we think this is hugely important, and we want to really somehow meld the ancient knowledge of indigenous peoples with the cutting edge machine learning driven models that we're building that are going to guide this process. And that's the way we're going to achieve impact at scale that really has a positive benefit on communities and takes into account all the dimensions of humanity's knowledge.
Do you see any conflict in their knowledge and your data, AI, technological numbers, and all those things that you bring into the app and the system and the algorithm? Or do you think that they are working together?
That is a great question, and it's one that I can't fully answer yet, but I will say that if there is any conflict, if our AI models are saying one thing and the indigenous elders who have lived on that land for many, many generations, we will follow the guidance of the elders every single time. That's a commitment we're making as a company, because that's the way that we can ensure that what we're doing is going to be good for everybody involved and good for the land itself.
What is your favorite tree? Who wants to go first?
That's a great question. I want to go first. I'm from New Zealand originally, and New Zealand has a lot of unique trees. So we have the kauri, the pohutukawa, the totara, like really beautiful trees. I have to say pohutukawa. It has this beautiful vermilion kind of blossom. And there was a huge pohutukawa tree I used to play on as a child. And that was really, maybe perhaps that's where my love of nature was first born. So I would say that the pohutukawa tree of New Zealand is my favorite. How about you, Troy?
Wow. I mean, so I'm in California at the moment, and the redwoods here are incredible, and really grateful to be able to go hike in the redwoods every day. I also love banyan trees. And also climbing in banyan trees. They're so good. So I've got a pretty long list, but those two are good for right now.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much, Troy and Patrick, for sharing all of that with me today.
Thanks for having us. Really appreciate the time.
Real pleasure. Thank you so much.
And thank you everyone for joining me today. We are all beautiful butterflies, each in his and her individual ways. I wanted to thank you for joining me today in this episode. I really appreciate you coming on this journey with me, and I hope you can join me next time. And remember, it only takes a small action to make a big difference. Be a butterfly.
And that's all for this episode. Thank you for joining us today. Please subscribe to hear more of our stories of change.